Community and Regional Affairs Committee, and with us today, Senator Stedman and Senator Ellis, myself, Stevens. We have several bills we're dealing with today. CS for House Bill 121, CS for House Bill 27, Senate Bill 188, and Senate Bill 179. So that's the order we'll take those in. Let's begin with CS for House Bill 121, and this is a companion bill to the bill that we've been hearing, Senate Bill 114. We've had three hearings on that. And I'd ask somebody from Representative Thomas's office, is it Ms. Schroeder? Thank you. If you identify yourself, please.
For the record, my name is Casey Schroeder. I'm a legislative aide for Representative Thomas, and I'm also one of the committee aides for the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee, who's the sponsor of this bill. I won't bore the committee with a long rendition.
Before you do, just for the record, Senator Kukesh is with us, so please go ahead.
I'm not going to go into the rationale behind the bill because I think you guys have,
yes,
have got that down, but I'd be happy to go over the changes that were made in the House.
Yes, if you do that.
Okay. The working part of the bill is on page 2. And in the House, we added three criteria that could be met before the borough assembly abolishes or consolidates the service area. And the first one is that road taxes haven't been levied for the past 12 months, and there's no balance in an account to pay for road services. The second one is that during the last 12 months, the road service area board has not met with a quorum. And the third one is that no road maintenance contracts are in existence, or if they are, they fail to provide minimum road standards to protect the borough from civil liability. And this is just an attempt to give the borough some guidelines on what needs to happen before they take action with the service area.
Thank you very much. So it really clarifies exactly what issues have to be in place before this would occur. So, yeah, that makes sense. Well, thank you very much. Any questions of Casey? Again, we've heard this three times. It's very similar to the bill we've dealt with before, Senate Bill 114. There is a zero fiscal note from DCCED, and from here it goes on to the right to the the rules in the Senate floor. I'd appreciate a motion to move. Are there any questions, any concerns at all? Appreciate a motion to move this out then.
Go ahead and make a motion that we move committee substitute for House Bill 121 out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you. Is there any objection to that? All right, we'll move that along. Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate you being here with us. The second bill we're dealing with is House Bill 27, optional exemption from municipal property taxes on certain residences of law enforcement officers. And we have Representative Grunberg.
Thank you
for being with us. We haven't seen you before here.
I'm glad to be here. Not too many of my bills have come through this committee, but I appreciate seeing the friendly faces and being able to bring this before you. I'm here on behalf of Representative Chenault and myself and the other co-sponsors. This is a bill that hopefully will help municipalities attract law enforcement officers to areas that need additional police protection. And Representative Chenault felt this would be helpful in Nikiski, and it will be helpful in parts of Anchorage that I represent and that Senator Ellis represents too. And what it does is it allows a municipality to enact an ordinance to define both the types of law enforcement officers who would be eligible for this and the area of the municipality that would be eligible, and to encourage them to live in that area, because if there's a police person living in an area, that can cut down the crime. You know, you have a cop on the block, and that really just, it doesn't cost the municipality anything except there'll be a small tax exemption that would wind up being about $2,200 per house. Property tax that could be exempted would be up to $150,000, and it would be done by an ordinance. It simply allows the municipal assembly to enact such an ordinance. And the reason we need this is because state law won't let them do this unless we allow this to be done under state law. And we define eligible area either as a weed and seed program, a renaissance zone, something like that, or alternatively as an area that has a higher occurrence of crime than the municipality as a whole, or that could meet both A and B. Thank you very much. We have Chief Monaghan and our deputy chief here, and I think we have some other supporters. I know we do.
Representatives.
And thank you very much.
So, as I understand this, there's no obligation on the part of the municipality. This is just an opportunity they have. Is that true?
That's true.
Further questions? Yes, Senator Stebbin.
Maybe the representative. Why can't this be handled at a local level?
It can, but it can't be handled without an enabling state law. The way Title 29 is set up, specifically AS 2945050, we have to provide a state law that allows the municipality to do it. It's an unusual state law that says they can't enact an ordinance unless this statute is amended to allow them to do it. And that's why there goes down to subsection S. There are a whole bunch of exemptions. This happens to be the latest.
Why? Is there a reason why firemen aren't included?
There's another section that deals with firemen. And last year, and if you can grab Title 29 and take a look at it, there's a parallel provision that came before us last year. May have been your bill. Yeah, it was Senator Wagner's bill. And Senator, Representative Chenault had it in the House. And right now, the volunteer firemen and EMS, fire people and EMS, only have it up to like 10,000. And there was a move to raise that to 20, and they stripped it, took it out of the bill in State Affairs Committee. I don't know why. It seems to me like something that would be a really good idea to do. It was for volunteer fire people, and but the bill sponsors for some reason didn't want to, and then the other half of the bill moved through last year. And we tacked this on as an amendment to that, but it was too late in the session to get it through. But you can take a look. It's the same statute. And I think it would be good to beef that up, too, but that's not what nobody said.
Because I was thinking more along the lines of the full-time paid fireman versus the volunteer.
Well, no, there's nothing in there now that encourages a fire person to live on the block. And we were looking at getting a police presence on the block. I don't know that it would help as much to have a fire person on the block. Maybe you can ask the chief that. And I don't know why they couldn't. If it's like an arson investigator or something, that might be considered a law enforcement person that could be defined in ordinance. If there was some feeling that that would help keep the crime down, I certainly have no problem with that. Long answer to a short question.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Grunberg? Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Senator Wagoner.
I'm sorry I was late, Mr. Chairman. I had.
Oh, I'm sorry, and for the record, Senator Wagoner is with us.
Your bill states if two or more individuals are eligible for an exemption for the same property, no more than two exemptions may be granted. Go into that in a little more detail, would you?
Sure. That actually was taken from the other subsection with the volunteer fire people. And the reason we're doing it, because sometimes law enforcement people may marry each other. And if there were two of them, then we would allow it to go up to double this amount, potentially. But if there were a group of people that went together, the feeling was we didn't want to just go this up. If there was a mother and a father and a child, you know, a grand, several, like three or more, we wanted to put the lid on this so the maximum they would get would be up to, the assessed value would be up to $300,000, which is way more than any value in Mountain View that I'm aware of in most of these other places. But that tracked the the language in the volunteer fire section. And by the way, we look to try to do something in the rural areas. Representative Thomas in the House CNRA committee, and we couldn't figure out how to do it. I'd certainly be willing to.
So, and that brings up a thought. I just, because you mentioned that, Senator Wagner, is there a time element on this? Does it only apply when a person is employed, if a person retires, if a person passes away, if a policeman leaves for one reason or the other? Is this a year-by-year thing that the boroughs do?
Yes, certainly. I would expect, and it was the intent, that it only applies if somebody's actively employed. If they're retired or leaves the employment, then I wouldn't think they would be eligible. And we just wanted to provide the authority for the municipality to enact the ordinance, but if I were drafting the ordinance, absolutely it's not the intent to have retired people. Now, if somebody were injured or something temporarily, that might be a different thing.
Sure. Thank you. Further questions? Senator Wagner?
Just a little clarification. Representative Gruenberg alluded to the $10,000, $20,000 amount. The bill finally did pass at $20,000.
Not with the... No, that provision on the volunteer was taken out.
Not the volunteer, but the bill that I had.
Yes. That was another section.
That was a different section, but this is much more generous. This is up to $150,000.
Yeah, the reason was... this was an amendment by Representative Cott with my support in the House CNRA committee, because if it was $10,000, that would have only provided, I think it was like a $200 or $300 tax break, not enough to attract anybody. In Mountain View, we had, and this is the area north of the Glen, we have not a single law enforcement person. There hasn't been anybody there for years. There's one person in Russian Jack, South Mountain View. In the eastern part of my district, which is a well-off part, there are a number of police. But we need them in the high-crime areas, frankly. And I'm sure that, I don't know the situation in Fairview, but...
Why they aren't there?
Yeah. Yeah. That's what we're trying to reverse.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any other questions, comments?
I'd appreciate particularly your help on this, too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Gruenberg, good to see you here. We have a couple of people to speak to us. Let's go to Steve Van Sant, who's the state assessor. Mr. Van Sant, do you have any comments, or just here for questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just here to answer any questions or fill in any gaps if I can, sir.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Appreciate you being with us. Let's go to those in the room here. Chief Monaghan, Walt Monaghan, if you come forward, please. Glad to have you with us. Chief, identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Walt Monaghan. I'm the Anchorage Police Chief. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for allowing me to testify. I support this bill, and in the interest of brevity, what I'd like to do is I'd like to speak on both my on behalf of myself as well as Deputy Chief Hune, which is seating in the back. I can give you a little bit of historical information. Over the years, I can recall that we've had similarly housing incentive kind of programs, either through federal or state kind of organizations. And APD's response to that is we've had about 12 people that I've been told that have actually participated. So this is a program that has some realistic opportunities for people to take advantage of. I support the bill for a number of good reasons, I think. Certainly, it aids in for the neighborhood to feel a little more safer to have a public safety officer visible. Since we have a home car program, that means that marked police car will be parked down in the street, so it enhances police presence. And also, I think having the neighborhood get to know the officers that would be in there, where they're more than just somebody driving by in a uniform. It's somebody that's mowing their lawn or doing something else, and it gives a humanistic approach. And I like that for two reasons. One, certainly for the neighborhood, again, to enhance their personal safety, but also for the officers to remind them that we are citizens in the community as well. The other thing I like about it is role models for youth. And to that end, and perhaps to answer the question about firefighters, I think that would be a very positive thing for inclusive of this program to include firefighters. Fact is, APD, I think, has a couple of police officers who have married over into the fire department, and that in itself may provide some enhancements if that happens. Again, but positive role models for youth. The other thing that has already been touched upon is the idea of recruiting and retention. Now, there's a lot of things that are up in the air, I understand, and they're being scrutinized. But regardless of how that comes out, the idea that part of the benefit of being a police officer or firefighter, if this passes with the firefighters, is having that ability to take advantage of finding some housing that will offer some incentives. So that would aid us in our abilities to recruit and retain. I truly believe that. So thank you for this opportunity. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to field them.
Well, thank you, Chief Monaghan. Senator Wagoner.
I'd just like to know, are your people aware of this bill going through the legislature, your Coleman?
There's a few of them that are. One of the reasons that I think we have our vice president of our union happens to be sitting in the audience, so I know that they do a very good job in keeping their membership informed as well.
Has there been any feedback to your office by those people that are aware of this that may want or may not want
to take advantage of it? I think they're just kind of waiting to see if this becomes available.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, I want to thank the chief for being here. I know you're busy, and we appreciate your support, and I thank Representative Grunberg and Representative Chenault for bringing this forward. I've represented Mountain View and still represent Fairview, and the feeling in a lot of those low-income and relatively high-crime neighborhoods is, you know, if the cops make a decent salary and live in more affluent neighborhoods, it fosters the us versus them, and they don't care about us. And any efforts that you can do after you staff up with 90 new officers over the next 5 or 6 years, if we can hopefully pull that off, you know, community policing and this kind of effort, you know, I think brings people into the neighborhood and breaks down a lot of those barriers. And as folks get to know the police, and the kids especially, have that kind of daily contact. So it's a great idea all around. I hope that you would encourage folks who, you know, if they're have a decent income or a two-family income, they could afford to live in Forest Park or up on the hillside. I hope there would actually be an active effort within the department or in the union to encourage people to help improve these neighborhoods. You know, Fairview, my neighborhood of Fairview and Mountain View are gentrifying to some degree, and those neighborhoods are on the upswing. Lots of good opportunities for decently priced homes there that can be fixed up as a good investment. And I hope you will try and sell this program to your officers.
Actually, certainly for the aspect of the benefit of the membership of the department, it would help us and I would do that. But for the benefit of the neighborhood, it by having more police presence and having the calming effect, and I think the encouragement and showing that there is change there, that also has an operational benefit for us. Crime does go down. I had the opportunity to be the CAP team commander when we had that federal grant where we had 15 officers up in Mountain View. And I can tell you by the end of the grant that driving just down the street on an afternoon like this, people out there raking the yards, doing a barbecue, kids were playing around there, they were waving, and they were using all of their fingers at the time. So it's a plus. And to see that, especially the youth, the kids, we used to have a little sticky badges, we called them. They're little adhesive metallic foil badges that we would give to kids. And the kids glommed onto that so much that actually it became a bit of a hazard. I remember being crouched down on a shooting or a sniping kind of call that was up in Mountain View one night, and a bunch of kids ran over and were asking me if I had sticky badges and putting themselves in the line of fire. So whatever we do, it's going to obviously have to be tempered, but I think that the direction's right in a program such as this, not only to help the officers, but to help the community.
Thank you, Chief. Any further questions? Thanks very much, Chief Monaghan. If anybody else wishes to speak to this at this time, anyone else? Yes, please, if you come forward, identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had signed up on, maybe somebody erased my name. That's possible.
Mike?
Mike.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I thought that was the assistant chief. I misunderstood.
He's been my boss in a number of ways. That'd be rough, you know. On good days and bad. My name is Sergeant Mike Couturier. I'm the Vice President of the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association, and that's who I'd like to represent here today. I appreciate the opportunity. This bill is certainly something that we're very interested in as a membership, and I can speak to some of the questions here, and some of my thunder's already been stolen. The recruiting retention issue, I'm also the backgrounds and recruiting sergeant for the Anchorage Police Department. I'm the one that's supposed to go find those 100 officers over the next 5 years. We have a very new and attractive brochure, which I now have to go back when you pass this through your committee and on to legislation, because this will be a very large, distinctive help in our attempt to attract qualified applicants. It will go right under pay and compensation package. As we reach out nationally for qualified police officers, this bill would affect them greatly. The relocation from the lower 48 up here is where this bill would actually, you would find it being used. You probably won't find an officer that lives out in Eagle River taking advantage of your bill and moving on into Mountain View. They're already established. They belong to a neighborhood. But as we hire on, this is will have a huge effect, and I think it will be used. So we're very in favor of the bill. As far as our membership is concerned, we have our own website. Our membership has already shown interest in this issue, and as Chief Monaghan said, in some cases have already taken advantage of past incentives. I can think of an officer, Steve Haas, off the top of my head right now, who now lives in Fairview. Both those neighborhoods, as police officers patrolling those communities, are definitely on the upswing. The thoroughfares getting cleaned up, new businesses moving in, Fairview leaps and bounds, of course. And this is just another piece of putting those communities on a better track than they had been in the past. The executive board recently met and discussed this bill and others, and we're very much in favor of supporting the bill, and another reason for me to be here today. And I'm willing to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mike. So, as I understand it, then it would be at the option of the local government, and they could exempt city police departments as well as state troopers. Is that your understanding?
That's correct. As long as those ordinances were let in those communities.
Up to that committee to make that decision. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Further questions?
No.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your comments. Senator Stone, I'm sorry.
I'm just kind of curious why at some hearings the officers are in uniform and then at some hearings they're not. Is there a reason for that?
Well, certainly we testify to have an effect, Senator. And when we come down representing the union, if we're going to wear a uniform, we have to receive permission to do that. We had that permission, if you're speaking of last Saturday. And we chose to take advantage of that. Today I'm representing the union, and therefore I'm not armed or in uniform.
Speaking of uniforms, we're envious that you can wear a short sleeve shirt, and we have to wear these ties.
Yeah.
Speaking of uniforms.
And my apologies for my comfort. Mine's in the cleaners.
Thank you very much, officer.
Thank
appreciate
you
being here.
That won't make a difference in our vote.
Okay, well, very positive comments here. I've been asked to hold it over for a chance to look at a few issues, and we can deal with this very quickly, I think. The next referral...
Have it back before us quickly?
Yes. The next referral is to finance, so it doesn't have far to go to get to the floor, I don't believe. So we'll hold that over until our next meeting. Now, the next item before us is Senate Bill 188, increasing the loan amount for the Rural Bulk Fuel Revolving Loan Fund. And is there someone from Senator Olson's office here?
He was out in the hall.
I'll go get him.
He's right there. Okay. There he is.
Oh, it's getting Senator Olson.
he's getting
Senator mad. Olson, thank you for being with us, Senator. Afternoon.
Respected members of the committee.
Mr.
Warm today in here.
Senator Stedman,
I think we should have the colleague that testifies in full uniform here today.
you'd look more positive on his testimony if he were.
Actually, I'll defer to the good wisdom of a gentleman on the committee to go ahead and make the decision as to the merits of the bill, because...
Well, we're having a little noise out there. Okay, if you'd identify yourself, then Senator Olson, for the record.
My name is Donald Olson. I'm the state senator from District T, which covers the North Slope and the Yukon, the Seward Peninsula, as well as the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. And it's these villages and towns that I represent that have brought this to my attention related to the increase in the amount of fuel that's being purchased, not so much in the amount of gallons, which really hasn't changed significantly, it's the amount of price that they're paying. I introduced Senate Bill 188 at the urging of the Governor's Rural Energy Action Council. The council met on April 15th in its report that they had recommended that they help rural communities contend with the rapidly escalating energy costs. Senate Bill 188 is one of those recommendations that I have that if enacted this session will allow communities to offset rising fuel costs with large purchase economies achieved through the bulk fuel loan program. This is particularly of concern for those communities that are icebound during the winter and depend on just one or two large shipments of fuel supplies for their needs throughout the entire year. Currently, the bulk loan program has a maximum amount of $300,000 that any one borrower can take in a fiscal year. The effect of this cap does, during times of high fuel prices, is to reduce the maximum amount of fuel that can be purchased. The bill will counteract this effect by increasing the cap from $300,000 to $650,000 for cooperative organizations that are purchasing bulk fuel for more than just one community. The larger purchase of multiple communities will result in lower per unit price for all users. I want to make sure that everybody understands that this loan cap relief applies only to communities that have a good credit rating, pay all their bills, and have a responsible record. The enactment of Senate Bill 188 will directly affect this fall's bulk fuel purchase for most communities in rural Alaska. This bill is timely and needed.
Thank you, Senator Olson. We do have a CS, and do you have that with you?
Actually, I do, Senator Stevens. You have a CS.
Maybe we could have a motion to adopt that, CS, Senator Wagoner.
I move the CS for Senate Bill number 188/F.
Thank you. And Senator Olson, if you could speak to that CS and how it changes the original bill.
I'd be glad to. It doesn't change what the basic foundation of the bill is. What it does do is allows, well, first of all, the version F draft of Senate Bill 188 actually has two significant changes that are there from the original bill that was actually recommended by the manager of the bulk fuel revolving loan program through the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. The first change, number one, would include electric utility cooperatives as a cooperative corporation that may use the loan fund for multiple community fuel purchases. Obviously, in the villages, one of the high price of energy is going to be electricity. Electricity uses a fair amount of petroleum products, mainly in the form of diesel, and that's why we're including them in this CS. The second change would provide a more flexible loan cap increase for multiple community fuel purchases from 600 to include 600, 900,000, and $1 million, depending on the number of communities that are cooperating together as one unit to go ahead and try and get a better price on their fuel product. You and I are well aware of the benefits that the state has reaped from higher fuel, the higher price of oil coming off the North Slope. This is also something that is going to be reflected in the amount of oil that needs to be purchased by these communities out in rural areas. And because of that, this allows them to go ahead and
work together cooperatively to try and get a price that's much more affordable so that life can go on and enjoy the same lifestyle that they have before. Because right now, things are looking fairly bleak. Those people that were on the margin before are certainly going to be maybe over the cusp if something is not done. And because of that, I urge passage of this bill.
Senator Olson, any questions? Senator Steadman?
Senator Olson, the CS still is more applicable to the communities that have good credit, pay their bills, or at least, you know, I recognize on occasion things get tight in particular communities, but they catch up and basically meet their obligations in the long run.
That's right, Senator Steadman. First of all, let me make it real clear. When, from a personal level, somebody borrows some money from you, they don't pay you back, you don't forget the experience. And it makes friends into, well, less friends, let's say that. And in that same spirit, we want to make sure that those communities that are responsible, that do put a high regard on their financial responsibilities, are able to go ahead and get fuel in the amounts that are needed, because the majority of the communities out there are good business people. They understand running short, and if we don't allow this cap to go through, I feel we're going to be in a position where they're going to run short, which means then you got to fly the fuel in. And, you know, with all due respect to people in the aviation industry, which is obviously one of the ways I make my living, I feel it's paramount that we go ahead and give them the benefit of the doubt so that they can take advantage of this program, get the fuel there, and not run short during the winter.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Any further questions? Thank you, Senator. We have a couple of people who would like to testify. Anything further you'd like to say at this point?
I'll just stay here unless there's anybody to testify here in the room. I'll be glad to go and answer more questions.
Well, thank you, sir. We've got a couple. Nils Anderson, I think, is off net, and Jim McMillan. So let's begin with Nils Anderson. Are you with us, Nils?
Hello, this is Nils Anderson in Dillingham.
Yes, Nils, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and Senator Olson, thank you for introducing this bill. What this bill would do is help us achieve a goal that the Rural Energy Action Committee had established, and that would be to encourage the creation of cooperative purchasing. But we would have run up against some obstacles which this bill helps alleviate, and that is taking a close look at why cooperatives haven't been formed in the past. And one of the obstacles was very clear that what came to the council was that if more communities could gather together and buy fuel in larger units, then of course we could bring the cost down. So we made it a test that if a bill like this would pass the test of encouraging the creation of cooperatives to bring down the cost of fuel for villages, then it would be good legislation. We think that passes the test. So I would encourage the committee to move committee substitute for Senate Bill 188 ahead. I think it'd be helpful in our long-term goal of bringing the cost of fuel down in the smaller communities across the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Any questions? I appreciate you being with us. Thanks. Jim McMillan from AEA, Alaska Energy Authority. Mr. McMillan, are you with us?
I am, Mr. Chairman. This is Jim McMillan. I'm Deputy Director of Credit and Business Development for ADA and AEA. AEA is supportive of Senate Bill 188. We believe that this is a step in the right direction in order to help reduce the cost of the purchase of bulk fuel for rural communities. We believe that the formation of cooperatives for the purposes of purchasing bulk fuel may be one factor that will help reduce the cost of purchasing fuel. And this change will allow a borrower who is a cooperative formed under AS 1015 or an electric cooperative organized under 1025 to borrow more than the current limitation of $300,000 per borrower. So for that reason, we do feel that this is a step in the right direction and do support the passage of the committee substitute for Senate Bill number 188. Also available, Mr. Chairman, to answer any questions that you or committee members may have regarding the bulk fuel revolving loan program.
Thank you, Mr. McMillan. I appreciate your comments. Any questions of Mr. McMillan? All right. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. Anybody else wish to speak to us at this time? I'd be willing to accept a motion to move this forward. Senator Wagner.
I'd move CS for Senate Bill number 188 /F with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection to that motion? All right. Thank you all. Thank you, Senator Olson.
Chairman, on behalf of the rural communities out there with this big dilemma in front of us, I want to go ahead and thank you and your committee for this as well.
Thank you, sir. And we'll go on to the last item on the agenda, Senate Bill 179 relating to the taxation of mining property. And this is an overview of the Donlin Creek joint venture. Mr. James Fugue, pleased to see you again, Mr. Fugue, if you'd come forward. Yes, please. Pleased to have you with us and look forward to hearing about this project.
Chairman, Senator, thanks very much for your time and the opportunity to update you on the status of Donlin Creek. I have a presentation that's part of a larger presentation that was given, so I'll skim through the highlights, try and keep it short for you, but if I can answer any questions at any point, please feel free to let me know. My name's James Fugue. I work for Placer Dome, and I'm the technical and permitting coordinator for the Donlin Creek Joint Venture. If you flip to page 2 of the handout, project location map, it shows the location of the Donlin Creek project, approximately 12 miles north of the village of Crooked Creek, which is located on the Kuskokwim River, some 180 miles upriver from the city of Bethel. As you can see, this is a very remote location. Currently, everything that goes in and out of the project does so by air. And if we were to develop a mine out there, all supplies for construction and operations would be barged up the river to a port located about 5 miles downriver from Crooked Creek, and then via road, which we'd be, we would construct to the mine site itself. If you move to page 3, the Donlin Creek Joint Venture. Donlin Creek is a joint venture between Placer Dome, who's the managing joint venture partner, and NovaGold Resources. The deposit itself, the resource, is owned by Calista Regional Corporation. They are the subsurface estate owner for the area. The surface estate is owned by the Kuskokwim Corporation, which is the regional village corporation. Placer Dome has a strong history of local participation. We've been out there nearly 10 years. We have a very strong local hire policy. We're both contractually and as a matter of corporate policy obligated to local hire. Current operations, we have some 50 to 70 people out there on any given day. It varies depending on what's going on. Our local hire statistics, and by local, I mean people from the immediate area, shareholders from the immediate area, typically run between 65 and 80% of the people in the camp. If we look at Alaska, a lot of our professional staff are drawn from Alaska as well, so overall, in terms of Alaska hire, that number would be somewhat higher. All access is by air, and right now, personnel are flown in and out by a local charter operator based in the town of Red Devil. So if we flip over a few pages to page 10, the slide entitled Current Resource Estimate. As I mentioned, we started working on the property in 1995. Our total expenditures to date are of the order of about $58 million. That's as of the end of last year. Of this, about $45 million was spent by Placer Dome and an additional $10 million by our partners, NovaGold Resources. Our budget for this year is of the order of $11.5 million. Our local payroll going to directly to shareholders in the area for the last month, running from the 20th of February to the 20th of March, which is the most recent statistics we have, was $180,000. That's a significant injection of money into the local economy. Despite the large amount of money that's spent out there, we're still several years and quite a few million more dollars from being able to make a final decision on whether or not to go ahead with the project. Where have we got to for all that money? The total resource as it stands right now is around 25 million ounces of gold, of which a total of 11 million ounces is what we call measured and indicated, and 14 million ounces is inferred. Measured and indicated is a reflection of the level of confidence that you need in that resource to be able to do a pre-feasibility study on it. A large part of our operations in 2005 are focused at converting more of that inferred resource to the measured and indicated category so we can move ahead with the pre-feasibility study. It's worth noting that not all of that 25 million ounces may necessarily be mined. That is driven by economics that will evolve as our studies advance and if we go to mining, as the mine itself advances, it's tied into gold price, operating costs, etc. Moving on a couple of pages to the slide, page 12, primary issues. These were a big focus of the work that was done in 2004. There's three major issues on which we find this project rests. Number one is power. There's no regional grid or generating capacity. The second one is lime. There's a requirement as part of the process for large amounts of lime. We believe we may have the solution to this problem because we've identified a low-grade lime resource in the region of the deposit, and we're currently drilling that out to see whether or not it's going to meet the requirements for the project. And then the other big challenge is obviously logistics, given the remote location. What are we looking for as a potential solution to the power in the next page? We're going to need somewhere around 80 megawatts. This is a significant amount of power, equivalent to a small city. We've evaluated some 10 different options and are now focusing on on-site generation using diesel. However, we're hoping to supplement this on-site diesel generation with wind generation. And we need to collect about a year's worth of data to fully evaluate this option, but the objective there would be to offset about 40% of the diesel requirement using the wind. Flipping on a couple of pages, page 15, logistics and infrastructure. As you can see from the slide, we'd need somewhere between 200 and 250,000 tons of consumables a year to operate. This material would be barged up the Kuskokwim River to a port location at Jungjuk Creek and then over road to Donlin Creek. The preliminary process outline, what kind of mine are we talking about here? For those of you who are familiar with Fort Knox, this would be something similar. It's a large open pit mine, a conventional open pit. We'd have two different pits, ACMA and Lewis. Truck and shovel mining, the ore would be blasted and loaded with loaders, put into trucks and trucked off to the mill. Three-stage crushing and primary ball milling, followed by flotation and what's known as pressure oxidation. Because the ore is at Donlin Creek is what's called refractory, it's tied up in the sulfide, we have to cook it, in essence cook it in a giant pressure cooker. This is a process known as pressure oxidation, and that's why we need so much power out there is to run this process. Moving on a couple of slides, again just to touch on the infrastructure. If we move ahead with this project, we'd be looking at building approximately 25 miles of road from the river to the site. We'd be looking at constructing a port and laydown area, a 6,000-foot surface runway to fly personnel and equipment in and out by air. All facilities associated with power generation, including the generation facilities, fuel storage, transmission lines, etc., a significant part of the project. Environmental studies have been ongoing since we commenced the project, continuing this year, all aspects of the process. If you look at the map on the following page, it's not just the project area itself that's being studied, but the entire access corridor up the Kuskokwim River down to the shores of Kuskokwim Bay. All these aspects need to be considered and evaluated to make sure that we can do this project in an environmentally sound manner before any decisions can be made. And then finally, where does it leave us as we stand today in 2005? Our basic project description calls for a 30,000 or 40,000 ton per day mill operation. Waste rock and initial tailings would be deposited in the American Creek Valley, which is the area in which the deposit lies, maybe later in the Anaconda Valley if we fill up the available area within the American Creek Valley. Supplies, including fuel, would be barged up the Kuskokwim River to a port at Jungja Creek. And then finally, we hope that power will be provided by on-site diesel, again, hopefully supplemented by wind if we are able to validate the resource. Our current anticipated construction costs, the direct costs for this project, are of the order of $1 billion based on the estimates we have to date. That's the actual cost of purchasing equipment, constructing buildings, building the infrastructure. It doesn't include construction overhead, so the total cost we're looking at is going to be significantly more than $1 billion. This is a big project with big scope. You know, we often think of it as three or four projects in one, and I certainly don't have the statistics to back this up, but I would suspect that if we went ahead, it would be the biggest private industry project in Alaska after the pipeline. So we're looking at a very big investment in an area that we feel this project could bring a lot of benefits to the people of the region. However, because of the remote location and the difficult nature of the process, we're looking at a huge capital investment. The project's also burdened with a remote location, relatively low grades, a complex ore to process. All of these things mean that this mine's going to have very, very high operating costs. As a result of that, we need to have a very sound understanding of the process, the economics. We need to have a well-defined economic model that we can run to take to our board and eventually to finance this project. Right now, one of the biggest unknowns in that economic model is the local taxation element, which is why we believe that Senate Bill 179 is so important to not just Donlin Creek, but any future projects such as Donlin Creek. It's not an issue of us wanting to bypass the local community. We recognize the concerns about imposing agreements on local communities, and we certainly respect and share your concern about all these issues. What we are doing is asking for some mechanism that we can use to negotiate and develop the tax certainty that we're going to need to move this project forward. Thank you very much. If I can answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, sir. I appreciate those comments. Can you give us an idea of the personnel required either now in the stage you're in and when it is in full operation? How many employees are we talking
right
about?
Now we're drilling, and I would suspect that through the summer we're going to run typically between 40 and 60 people on any given day. During construction, we suspect these numbers would be of the order of 600 people, probably for a matter of 2 years. And then during operation, somewhere between 350 and 400 people, depending on the scale, on the size of the mill we settle on, and so on.
Okay, thank you. And then could you just tell me, what happens with the ore once you have finished with it at the site? Where does it go from there?
This is a gold mine, strictly a gold mine. It's not, for example, like a copper mine or a lead and zinc mine where you make a concentrate, which has to be backhauled and then sent to a smelter and processed. We actually make gold bars on site, which would then be loaded into airplane and flown out.
Oh, I see. So you would have the finished product will be made.
Finished
right
project there. Product would be taken out. Yeah.
Thank you for the questions, Senator Wagner.
Yeah, these are 1 mile grids on the map, the site map.
I believe so. If I can.
Or you're showing the site of the mine and the tailing option.
That's correct. Yes, those are the section lines.
Very good. Any further questions, comments? Senator White, I'm sorry, Senator Stedman.
I'm just kind of curious, you know, to run a 300 or 600 person crew, are you going to be transporting them in and out of Anchorage, or are they going to be mostly out of Bethel, or?
We, you know, would hope and certainly would work towards having a high element, a local hire, and what we'd do is probably something similar to what's done at Red Dog. We'd have flights going to Anchorage for those people who choose to live or operate out of Anchorage, and then we'd have smaller, you know, twin-engine or Cessna 206 charter aircraft that would do routes to the various local villages. Probably we would be looking at something like a two-on, two-off rotation, where you'd work 2 week period, 12 hours a day, and then be off for 2 weeks, or, you know, 2 weeks on, 1 week off, however that would pan out.
And then the mine would run 24 hours a day?
24 hours a day, 365 days a year, yes. Because of the nature of this process and the autoclave that we'd be using, It's not something that you can easily shut down. It has to run continuously.
And then after you dig the big hole in the ground, and what kind of reclamation is done?
We're currently working on a reclamation plan. We look at all the issues, the water balance, the long-term handling of water, habitat, meteorology, all those studies. And if you look at the list of studies on that page, there are a lot of different disciplines that are involved. All that data is currently being compiled and will be used to develop a long-term reclamation plan. At this point, I couldn't really comment on the exact specifics of it. It is an evolving document, but certainly the intent is to, you know, obviously we cannot leave things as they were before they were mined, but we certainly would not want to leave them in any way that would leave any kind of issues behind us once the mine has moved on.
What's the current estimated lifespan of the mine once it's in operation?
That's a difficult question to give a precise answer on. It depends on the size of mill we settle on, you know, what percentage of the reserves we can of the resource we can actually mine. A good sort of ballpark number for right now that we're using is about 15 years. It's probably worth noting that historically, mines typically tend to run longer than their estimated life at the beginning of construction.
Thank you. Senator Wagoner?
Yeah, we've got another bill we've been hearing dealing with mines located not in a organized area
mm-hmm.
in the borough. And I believe...
That's the one we're dealing with. That's in about 179. Right? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah. That is this bill. Okay.
Right, right.
And there's some concern about that being a high enough mill rate to do what needs to be done if that area incorporates. And
mm-hmm.
What are your feelings on that?
Well, as a Placer Dome representative, I'd like to speak to the Diamond Creek project, and you know, one could maybe approach people representing other projects for their perspective. But if we take, for example, Diamond Creek at a $1 billion direct capital cost, assume that most of that's going to be taxable, we're talking about $1 million per mill. The way the bill stands right now, it's 4 mills. Upon formation of a burrow, it goes to 6 mills, with those 2 mills being used to operate a burrow. We'd be talking about a $2 million operating budget for a rural borough with, you know, assuming that they go with the model borough, which would be the Custburg School District, I think a population of the order of 1,500 people. If you look at some of the other rural boroughs in Alaska, that is certainly, I'd say, more than in line with what their typical operating budgets are.
And then in addition to that, there's additional taxes amount about 9 or 10%, and corporate taxes.
Both corporate and mining license taxes, yes. In addition to that, there is a royalty that would go to Calista Corporation under our agreement with them.
Oh, okay. Because it's their land and their
resources. It's their resource, and we mine it under lease from them. So there is a significant royalty component that goes to Calista.
So basically, we're talking about a mining license, corporate tax, royalties, and then whatever property tax millage there may be.
Correct. Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about your corporation and the other joint venture, so we'd have an idea of who you are and what your background
certainly,
is?
Certainly.
Maybe successes in the past.
Unfortunately, I think we removed that slide from the presentation. Placer Dome is an international mining company. We're headquartered in Vancouver, Canada. I believe that right now we have in the region of 18,000 employees. We have mines scattered across the world from Africa to Indonesia, Australia, North and South America. We operate a couple of mines in Nevada, one in Montana. Donlin Creek is our only project in Alaska. Placer Dome has a history, I think you could say, or fairly say, of building mines in undeveloped areas similar to what we're facing at Donlin Creek. Perhaps the best two examples are our mine in Indonesia at Porgera and then the Musselwhite mine in northern Canada, which are similar to Donlin Creek, located in areas that are completely undeveloped, and to a large extent, other than the mine, still are completely undeveloped. I think we have a very good history of working with the native peoples in those areas. And one of the cornerstones of Placid Dome's philosophy of doing business is our sustainability policy, which requires us, when we evaluate a project such as Donlin Creek, to look at what we'd leave behind us and what the long-term benefits of the community would be. We recognize the fact that mining is not a renewable resource. There's going to be a point at which at which that resource is going to be mined out and the company is going to move on. That is the nature of our business. And it's a requirement, a corporate policy requirement, that we be in a position when we move on to leave something behind us. Typically that takes the form of a more educated workforce. One of the hidden benefits of a mine like Donlin Creek is the contracting opportunities that are going to develop out there. Fuel, barging, air transport, laundry, I mean, catering, you name it, the opportunities are endless. And we think that the mine can serve as a catalyst for, I don't know if the word, correct word is industry, but certainly for the development of multiple businesses out of there. It'll serve as a resource for development of a skilled labor force, hopefully one day an educated labor force. We'd certainly, as a company, like to see future engineers and geologists, not just necessarily heavy equipment operators or mining staff. If you go to Placid Dome's head office in Vancouver, you'll hear a lot of accents, people from Indonesia, people from Africa, you name it, people from Musselwhite. I mean, it truly is a multinational company in that sense. So I think we can justifiably say we've been very successful at that policy of incorporation. I think that's a snapshot of the company. We produce about 4 million ounces of gold a year, plus a few hundred thousand tons of copper. And we currently have three large projects similar to Donlin Creek being one of them, at a similar sort of stage of development that we're evaluating. One of them in northern Chile, South America, and one of them in the Dominican Republic. And right now we're evaluating all three of those projects with the idea to possibly putting them into development sometime in the next few years.
Thank you, sir. And just how far is it from Bethel to the mine site?
Creek? I would say it's of the order of 180 miles. I don't have the exact number at my... Depends on what the weather's doing the day you fly up.
And the nearest community is Aniak, or is that...
The nearest community of any size would be Aniak. The nearest town itself is Crooked Creek, and that's 12 miles due south down the Crooked Creek Valley.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Well, I'd just like to pursue this mill rate a little more because we've been caught up on it. So you don't feel that's excessive?
To be perfectly honest, when we first looked at this proposal, we were hoping for something a little lower, and we're still trying to evaluate exactly what effect that's going to have. It's certainly, I don't know if it's fair to use the word, it is a burden to the project. However, that being said, we certainly recognize our obligations to the local community, and we, as a company, have taken a position of neutrality, if you will, on the issue of borough formation in the area. We do not want to be in a position of sort of encouraging or discouraging borough formation. We want to meet our commitment to the local people in terms of education, and should they choose to form a borough out there, we'd certainly like to contribute our fair share to the operating costs of that borough, recognizing also the fact that we would not be drawing any services whatsoever from a local borough. We'd be building all our own infrastructure and maintaining all our own infrastructure from sort of water and sewer through, snow clearing, the whole works. So,
thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Fury. I appreciate your time, and it's great to see what this project potential is. Thanks a lot. Any further to come before the committee at this point? If not, we're adjourned.